This hour on Open Line, allegations of sweatshops, worker abuse, and they're not limited to clothing manufacturers. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle. A workers' rights group has released a report accusing Toyota of abusing its workers and buying parts from suppliers which operate sweatshops. The report was done by the National Labor Committee. That's the same group that linked talk show host Kathy Lee Gifford's clothing line to Central American sweatshops. The National Labor Committee report alleges that Toyota uses low-wage temp workers to build the Prius Hybrid, the popular new car. It says Toyota's supply chain is filled with companies that force employees to work 16-hour days at wages half the legal minimum wage. Joining us is one of the authors of the report, Charles Kernighan. He's the executive director of the National Labor Committee. Charles, welcome to Open Line.
Very good to be here.
Let's start off with the news, which the report was released recently, targeting Toyota and specifically the Prius, the much-celebrated hybrid car that gets about 50 miles to the gallon. The Prius, it's the golden child of the auto industry right now. It's going to save the planet. And Toyota just announced it will put solar panels on the roof of the Prius. But your report found that there is something else hidden in the manufacture of this automobile.
Yes. We think that the mileage and of the Prius is excellent. And so, I mean, we're certainly a supporter of these kinds of automobiles. The problem is when we went to Japan, it was very shocking to us to find out that one-third of all the assembly line workers working for Toyota in Japan, we're talking 10,000 of these workers are temps, low-wage temps. They're hired at about half the wages of the full-time workers. They're hired just for 4 months. Up to about two years and 11 months. They have no rights. It's just not known in the United States that Toyota is pursuing this low-wage two-tier model with these low-wage temps with no rights. Also, workers are being overworked to death at Toyota plants, including the Prius plant. We interviewed a young woman whose husband was overworked to death at the Prius plant. He worked basically 70 to 80 hours a week. He was an inspector on the line, inspecting the car bodies of the Priuses when they came off the assembly line. He was working, like I said, 70 to 80 hours a week, basically shifting from day shift to 1 week, then he would shift to the night shift the next week. In the night shift, for example, he was getting there at 3:20 in the afternoon and not leaving until 5:20 a.m. the next morning. So he was leaving his house at 2 o'clock, driving his Toyota car to the factory, and he wasn't getting home until 7 o'clock the next morning when his wife and kids were just getting up. He died of overwork. In the 30 days leading up to his death, he had worked 155 hours of overtime, of which Toyota recognized just 45 hours. They said the other 110 hours were voluntary and off the record and off the books. And this happened in 2002. She was left alone, this woman, with her one-year-old son and three-year-old daughter. Toyota wouldn't give them a pension, wouldn't help the family in any way. She had to go to court to sue to get a pension. And when she went to court, it took 6 years, but the court ruled that her husband, Mr. Kenichi Uchino, who died at 30, was overworked to death at the Prius plant and demanded that the family finally receive the pension. But it was story after story like this in the subcontracting chain that supplies auto parts to Toyota. Now, they don't own these factories. They're just their subcontract plants that supply Toyota. The government of China and the companies have been trafficking low-wage workers from Vietnam, mostly from Vietnam and China, to Japan. Many of them end up, there's 70,000 workers a year at least who are trafficked into Japan. They're stripped of their passports. They're now people without a country. They're not covered by minimum wage or labor laws in the first year, so they're like sitting ducks. So many of them end up in these supply factories, these subcontract factories. They're working 16 hours a day, 8 o'clock in the morning until midnight, 7 days a week, and they're being paid about one-third of the minimum wage in Japan.
Tonight, we'll go piece by piece through the report. Yes. I just want to make sure that we can invite our listeners to take part in the conversation. 292-8513, 292-8513. 8513 is the phone number to call. We also welcome your emails at openline@wosu.org. Let's go through the report. You mentioned the part-time temporary workers. They make 60% of what full-time workers make, do they have no benefits or much lower scale
of benefits? Much lower scale of benefits. So when you, the wages are actually, for a full-time worker at the Toyota plant, the wage is $20.50 an hour, $42,600 a year. You know, it's a good wage. Japan's more expensive than the United States, so it's not a tremendous wage, but it's a good, very solid wage. The temp workers are getting just $12 an hour, $24,000 a year. And in Japan, you can't live on that. And they're getting lower benefits. And they have no rights. And they're hired, like I said, just for 4 months with up to 2 years and 11 months.
And this is these are plants in Japan, primarily, where these temp part-time workers are made.
Yes. In fact, Toyota has in Japan about 30,000 assembly line workers, of which 10,000 are these temps. And this is also true in the Prius factory.
Okay. So is it just the Prius or are there other Toyota
No, it's all. It's right across the board for Toyota. Toyota's been experimenting with these two-tier contracts for the last 30 years. They started it way back in the 60s when agricultural workers were out of work seasonally, and Toyota would hire them for very low wages. So it's something that they've been evolving for years. And sad to say, it's now in the United States. Toyota is now implementing this two-tier wage structure at its non-union plants across the south of the United States.
292-8513, 292-8513, if you'd like to speak with Charles Kernighan. He is the executive director of the National Labor Committee. The committee monitors and polices sweatshops and unfair labor practices around the world, exposes sweatshops and in which companies they supply. Their latest report targets Toyota as a violator of workers' rights. We did invite Toyota to take part. They declined to be on the air, but they did issue a statement, and we'll refer to that statement periodically throughout the program. And on this issue of the part-time workers, Toyota claims that the National Labor Council paints a what they call a false picture of the use of temporary workers. They say, quote, Toyota's use of temporary workers is in line with common auto industry practice. Temporary workers are treated well, Toyota says, and compensated fairly. In fact, when permanent positions become available, they are filled by our temporary workers, unquote. The statement from Toyota. Charles, how do you respond to that?
Well, it's true, but it's not the way they make it sound, because yes, the temporary workers work right next to the full-time workers on the assembly line. We toured the plants. We saw this. They just have different color lettering on their hats. They work like crazy because Toyota management says to them, listen, if you want a good full-time job, you just be a special worker. So the temps are working even harder. They're pitting like the temps against the full-time workers. So the temps are like killing themselves to see whether or not they can get one of, you know, the very few positions that may open up. So and as a matter of fact, the workers have very few rights. So it's really pitting the temps against the full-time workers. And, you know, like Toyota can say what it wants, but we talked with the workers. Mm-hmm. They told us what the reality was in terms of overtime, unpaid overtime. Every single month, you know, Toyota has this great reputation for its quality circles. That means workers get together maybe several times a month to come up with two ideas each month, which would increase productivity and lower labor costs. But those meetings are all off the book. They're voluntary. They're unpaid. So you have virtually every single worker in Toyota is forced to work some overtime, unpaid overtime. You know, maybe not to the extent of Mr. Uchino, who was working 155 hours overtime, but there is also unpaid overtime at Toyota. So when you start to put all these pieces together, of course, they're slashing labor costs. You got low-wage temps, you have unpaid overtime. Then you have a supply chain which is just riddled with sweatshop abuse, including human trafficking.
Are the U.S. automakers, I think, as you know, the big three here in the United States, are renegotiating contracts with the unions. And I know Delphi has renegotiated part of its contract before it declared bankruptcy. And these two-tiered wages were a part of U.S. automakers' practices as well, were they not?
Yes, absolutely. And this is why bells went off in my head when I was in Japan interviewing the workers. The model that Toyota uses essentially is to pay in Japan they pay 50% to the temporary workers. They pay 50% above the minimum wage. And in Japan, in the auto industry, the minimum wage is about $7.85 an hour. So Toyota pays 50% above that for about $12 an hour for the temps. That's exactly what Toyota is doing in the United States now. Toyota used to pay parity with the union wages of the big three. So if the big three workers got $28, $29 an hour, Toyota would pay $25 an hour to stay close. Their benefits in the U.S. are much, much lower than the U.S. workers. But they paid rough parity with the wages. They're no longer going to do that. Toyota is announcing that they are now going to pay just the prevailing wage in the region in which they work or the county. They'll pay the prevailing wage plus 50%, which is their exact model in Japan, which they've been using for 30 years. So we're going to see these wages in the auto industry continue to drop and benefits continue to drop. I believe Toyota's leading this thing. And once a company, it's the biggest car company in the world right now, Toyota. Once one company does it, especially an effectively run company like Toyota, which is the largest auto company in the world now. It's bypassed Ford as the second biggest company in the United States, auto company, and it's only 10,000 cars behind passing General Motors. So once the biggest company like this takes these steps to slash wages and benefits, if you don't follow, you get killed. I mean, this is the whole race to the bottom, which has now hit the auto industry.
292-8513, if you'd like to speak with Charles Kernighan. He is the executive director of the National Labor Committee, the group that looks out for workers' rights around the world and monitors and exposes sweatshops. The more disturbing part of the report, as I read it, was what was going on, what you allege was going on in the supply chain. The suppliers, the report found, are running sweatshops and supplying the parts that go into Toyota vehicles.
Yes, yeah, and the worst part of that, like I mentioned earlier, would be the human trafficking of these guest workers, foreign guest workers from very poor countries like Vietnam and China, Indonesia, maybe Brazil. And when the workers get there, they're stripped of their passports. Now, once you don't have a passport, you have no rights. Then you're assigned to one factory. And if you leave that factory, you'll be beaten up and deported. You're assigned to housing. And you can't move. If you move, you'll be deported. And when you can't move, they cheat the workers of the rent. They charge them excessive rent. So these workers are really in bad shape, working from 8 o'clock in the morning, like I mentioned, 16 hours to 12, 7 days a week. And they're getting wages of maybe about $2.87 an hour, which is a third of the minimum wage. And in one factory, they actually charge the Vietnamese women 15 cents for every minute they spent in the toilet going to the bathroom.
This is the minimum wage in the countries where they are?
No, in Japan. They're working in Japan. They're trafficked to Japan, and they're working in Japan. But unfortunately, this is human trafficking. When you strip a worker's passport, that's human trafficking. It's a very serious, serious violation. In fact, they've been challenged by the U.S. government on this issue of human trafficking, and Japan has on human trafficking and forced labor.
To again read from the statement from Toyota, the company says, quote, the fact is that no Toyota company has ever been involved in confiscating guest worker passports, and Toyota has no workers subject to a guest worker program. They characterize the NLC report as inaccurate. Your response to that, Charles?
Well, they work in subcontract factories, which Toyota doesn't own. So, this is done all over the world. So, in other words, yes, they're not directly employed by Toyota, but they make parts for Toyota, and those parts go to Toyota. And, there's terrific sweatshop abuse in their supply chain, which, again, shocked us greatly. We had a very, very different image of Japan than the one the workers introduced us to. And so there's absolutely guest workers who are stripped of their passports and have zero rights who are making auto parts for Toyota. They're not in Toyota-owned plants. These are subcontract factories.
So they're making,
they are there.
They're making the subcontractors supplying the, things like the door locks or the carburetors or whatever might be going into the car.
Exactly. And it's also Japanese workers who are under a great sweatshop conditions. We spoke to one worker who was making the cross member bars, which are engine supports. And he was working from 8 o'clock in the morning until 11:30 at night or 1 a.m. So this guy was working like from 8:30 in the morning until 11:30 at night or 1 a.m. He was working 15 to 16 and a half hours a day, 7 days a week. And we said to him, look, sounds impossible. He said, I know it sounds impossible, but we do it. He described the factory as a prison. He was only making $6.90 an hour. He had to stamp out one cross member bar on this big punch press machine, one every 3 seconds, 1,300 an hour, and about 20,000 in the day. And, of course, his arms were shot. He said he was so exhausted when he would go home to sleep, but he couldn't sleep because his arms were just throbbing with pain. And eventually he lost control of his hands. He couldn't even hold the glass, so the glass would just fall and drop. So it's not just the guest workers. It's also the Japanese people themselves in these subcontract factories who are being abused and their labor rights are being denied. The big thing here, and why Toyota, I think, has gotten away with this for years, and again this shocked us, is that there's enormous fear in Japan among the workers, that if they dare speak up, if they dare criticize Toyota, they're out the door. So the fear level in Japan among Toyota workers was astounding. I mean, we've never seen anything like it. So it almost felt like a developing country. Workers were so terrified that they'd lose their jobs that people were very afraid to go on the record. They wouldn't speak openly about the name of their factory. It was something that, again, keep using the word, but it surprised us and shocked us a great deal.
Okay, we're speaking with Charles Kernighan, the executive director of the National Labor Committee. This is the group that polices sweatshops and exposes sweatshop practices around the world and links them to the products that you all, that we all purchase and can recognize very easily. Nasrullah, you're on the air with Charles Kernighan.
Good morning. How are you?
Thank you. How are you this morning?
Good, good. Just want to know about, I'm glad you brought the issue of sweatshop. It's the new trend on it's a global capitalist. Everywhere you go, you'll find them. They are carry their little sweatshop around. Is there any law in Congress that they're working on abuse of human rights or offering voucher of steady income for people of different nationality rather than facing this vulture capitalism, you know?
Charles, there is a bill before Congress.
Yes, this is very exciting. It's a, you know, great question. It's a bill in the House. It's called House Resolution 1992. And in the Senate, it's Senate Resolution 367. It was introduced by Senator Byron Dorgan from North Dakota, but it's a big supporter is Senator Sherrod Brown, Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, and many others in Ohio. This bill, for the first time, essentially says to corporations, you can go offshore, you can bring your products back to the United States, but you will not bring those products into the United States if those products are made by children, if those products are made by forced laborers who are held under slave conditions. You're not going to bring them into the United States if they violate the minimum labor laws in these countries. Suppose it's China. Well, it's a 40-hour work week. They have laws in China, a minimum wage of about 60 cents an hour. It's nothing, 62 cents an hour. So we're not setting minimum wages around the world. All we're saying is you have to obey local labor laws in these countries and you have to obey the ILO, the International Labor Organization, core labor rights standards for freedom of association, you know, right to organ, right to collectively bargain. So this legislation, which everybody said it was a dream, that it would never, ever happen, it has about 170 co-sponsors in the House right now and 26 co-sponsors in the Senate, including Senator Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton. So right now there's actually legislation out there which for the first time will hold corporations legally accountable to respect fundamental human, women's, and worker rights. And why this is so appropriate is because the companies have demanded all sorts of legal protections for their trademarks, like, you know, the Swoosh and the Mickey Mouse and the Barbie doll and all the rest of it.
Piracy issues.
Yeah, intellectual property copyright laws. So they have laws, enforceable laws, to back up their trademarks and their privacy, which are backed up by sanctions, and you'll go to prison if you're caught bringing in knockoffs or imitations. But there's no laws to protect the rights of the human being. This has to be changed.
As we have seen with the piracy laws and the copyright infringement laws, it can be difficult to enforce. How does this bill, how would the U.S. government investigate and enforce this anti-sweatshop bill?
Well, it's a... would work on several levels. Because the minute, the most important part actually would be the minute the corporations know that they have to respect internationally recognized worker rights standards, that it's no longer a voluntary code of conduct, that there'll be a private monitoring scheme. Once they know they're actually going to be held accountable to laws, you will see the U.S. companies begin cleaning up these factories almost overnight, because they will finally be held legally responsible. So the big impact of this thing will just be driving the companies to clean up these factories, because they'll know the joyride's over. They're not going to be able to bring child products made by children or slave labor or sweatshop labor into the United States. It's just not going to happen. So they will immediately start cleaning up these factories. But the bill would be overseen by the Customs Department for imports, and in trade between the states, it would be the International Trade Commission. But in the legislation, there's a very important private right of action, which says that other retailers, for example, could sue a retailer that's violating the law, that's undercutting them by unfair trade practices. So you have several rungs here which would make this legislation very effective, and one of them being the private right of action. You could sue one of these retailers if you can prove that they're, you know, violating the rights of workers, and again, using like children or using like slave labor and people who have been trafficked and stripped of their rights, you can then sue that company.
What kind of penalties would the companies face? Would it be prison time? Would it be heavy fines?
It would be fines. You know, that would be worked out. Basically, fines. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be as strong as the laws that the corporations have to protect their products. Like just a little while ago, some Nike Air Jordan stuff was brought into the United States through the port of New Jersey, along with some Coach bags, all of them phony knockoffs. The people who brought those knockoffs to the United States, they're now facing 35 years in prison for violating the property rights of Nike and Coach. So this legislation isn't anywhere near as strong as that, but at least we're getting there. But at this particular point, there's legal protections for the product, but absolutely zero protections for the human beings who make them. And again, until that changes, until there's a level playing field, you'll never stop this race to the bottom.
Okay. We are speaking with Charles Kernighan. He's the executive director of the National Labor Committee. We're talking about sweatshops and workers' rights around the world, highlighting their latest report, which is very critical of Toyota and the way it treats its employees and the way Toyota's suppliers treat their employees. We'll continue with Charles Kernighan after we take a brief break. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle on Open Line here on WOSU 820.
Next time on Day to Day, some financial advice applies to everyone.
Save, don't live beyond your means.
But not all of it.
Insurance, medical insurance, how much you need to save, those kinds of things can vary.
Your financial needs may depend on your marital status, your sex or race, even your job.
You do know you work for NPR, right?
Some books for better budgeting next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in just about 30 minutes. It starts at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 81 degrees at 11:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News. Don't forget that weekday mornings you can prepare for the day with Morning Edition, starting at 5 a.m., now on WOSU 89.7 FM. In the weather forecast for today, showers and thunderstorms later this afternoon and a high of 88.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle on WOSU 820. We are speaking with Charles Kernighan, the executive director of the National Labor Committee. They're the sweatshop watchdog agency, private agency that monitors sweatshop and workers' rights and the violations of those rights around the world. We are talking a lot today about the new report, which is very critical of Toyota, accusing it of unfair labor practices and using suppliers who run sweatshops. Again, we invited Toyota to come on and to respond to this. They have released a statement. Let me just read part of that statement, then we'll move on with our discussion of Toyota and other problems around the world. Toyota says the National Labor Committee's report contains numerous inaccuracies that present a false and misleading picture of the company. Toyota continues, contrary to the report's allegations, Toyota respects its employees and honors the basic human rights of the people involved in our business. We comply with all applicable local laws and regulations wherever we operate while providing fair compensation and benefits. Consistent with our guiding principles, we provide a safe, healthy working environment for all of our employees. And Toyota continues that on an ongoing basis, we also strive to ensure that our suppliers and subcontractors adhere to these standards. To be clear, Toyota says Toyota has zero tolerance for any form of forced or child labor, and we will not knowingly work with companies that are engaged in any of these practices. Charles, you've got the company's attention. What do you expect Toyota to do now?
Well, there are several steps they could take immediately to try to meet the words that they're issuing. They've actually been warned by the government of Japan regarding textile factories that make subcontract plants that make like the auto seats, the armrests, and the headrests, that 60% of those factories were involved in human trafficking, wage violations, hour violations, health and safety violations, and so on. So Toyota knows what's going on, but they have the right to say the words they want. But Toyota, talk about human rights, Toyota is actually in a partnership with the Burmese dictators in Burma. Which, again, came as another shock to us. We couldn't believe it. What is a company like Toyota doing in Burma with the military dictators? You know, you can't run a business in Burma without being involved and in bed with the Burmese dictators. That's the way it works. Now, Toyota, through its group of companies, that's 13 companies called the Toyota Group. One of those companies is called Toyota Tsusho. It's like a trading company. Toyota Tsusho is involved in a joint venture with Suzuki, another Japanese car company, and the Myanmar Auto and Diesel Engine Company, which is the military, in making vehicles. Toyota is also involved. Myanmar Toyota Tsusho has a trading company inside of Burma with 90 employees trading in auto parts and other commodities. And there's another company called Toem, which is a part of the Toyota Group, which is also involved in Burma. So the first thing we're asking Toyota to is get out of Burma. You have no right. There's no reason to be in bed with the dictators who are using the revenues they're making to torture their own people and murder their own people. Forced labor, extrajudicial killings, rape, disappearance, torture, child labor. It still goes on in Burma. So we want Toyota out of Burma. They could do this tomorrow. It would take them half a second. In the Philippines,
now, let's stick with Burma for a sec. Toyota says that your report mischaracterizes its involvement in Burma. They say, quote, the truth is Toyota's involvement in Burma is extremely minimal. They say Toyota withdrew from Burma in 2000. Quote, we sell no vehicles there other than to UN entities or foreign embassies. Again, are we talking about the difference between Toyota companies and subsidiaries of the company? Yes. Are we splitting hairs?
Yes. In other words, it's another sleight of hand debating technique, because there is a Toyota group of companies which has 13 or 14 companies in it, and the board of directors rotates within these different companies. Management goes back and forth. And, in fact, Toyota owns about 31% of Toyota Tsusho outright. So anybody you would speak to who's knowledgeable about this would say that if Toyota issued one single word to Toyota Tsusho, if they said, you know, out, you know, out of Burma, Toyota would be out of Burma. Toyota Tsusho would be out of Burma the next day. So Toyota has the ability to stop collaborating with the military dictators, and they could do it in literally a day.
292-8513, 212-8513, area code 614, 1-800-292-8513 if you would like to take part in this conversation. If you agree or if you disagree with this report, we'd like to hear from you. 292-8513, area code 614, to speak with Charles Kernighan, the head of the National Labor Council, the watchdog of sweatshops around the world. Charles, let's sort of step back a bit. I'm interested to know how you actually do your work, how you investigate not just Toyota, which we're talking about in this case, but all allegations of worker rights abuses. How do you start? You get a tip, and then what do you do from there?
Yes. Basically, we get appeals for help from workers around the world. You know, we've been doing the work long enough. We're very small. We're four people. I mean, we're a very tiny organization, nonprofit. But despite that, we're getting emails and phone calls from all over the world. So, for example, with Jordan, which was a U.S. free trade agreement, we had a free trade agreement with Jordan, which descended into slavery, some of the worst conditions we've ever seen. The way we found out about that is a worker sent us a badly, poorly written, handwritten fax in English, which was not his language. It was all broken English, very difficult to read, begging for help. It was a Bangladesh worker who had been trafficked to Jordan, and he wrote us, "Please help us. You know, they're beating us. They're raping our women. They're killing us." And that was the first time we even heard of the Jordan Free Trade Agreement. We immediately, verified what the person had written. And within a short time, we were on a plane to Jordan and just went undercover and met as many as workers as we could.
So you go undercover, you pose as workers, you go into the factories?
No, that you can't do, because in Jordan, it was all guest workers, tens of thousands of them from Vietnam, Bangladesh, China, Sri Lanka, India. And there's very heavily armed free trade zones. So basically what we do is we set up a network where we can meet with the workers in safety. Mm-hmm. And in this, they were working such extraordinary long hours. The only time the workers could meet with us was 10 o'clock at night, maybe between 10 and 10:30. And then they had to get back to the dorms because they had curfews. So we would meet in some poor, broken-down tea shop where the managers would never go. No one would ever suspect anything. And we spent a good deal of time in Jordan, and we just did interview after interview after interview in these broken-down tea shops and just gathered firsthand information from the workers. They're trained to take the labels out of the factories so we know what they're producing, bring any other documents they possibly can. And then, you know, sometimes just on our own, not with the workers because it would endanger them, we would try to sneak into the free trade zones just to take some pictures and things like that. You know, once we got in, most of the times we were caught.
So this is how do you go about confirming allegations? Just by sheer numbers of people you talk to?
Yes. Everything is like just if you – I mean, we've been doing this for 20 years mm-hmm. now. So if you interview like a group of workers and then the next day or a few days later – you interview a different group of workers from the same factory, and you're basically asking the same questions, and you're mixing it up a little bit. When you keep getting the same answers from workers, you know it's the truth. And as a matter of fact, in 20 years, no one's put a single dent in any of the research. All of our research is done directly, face-to-face with the workers, and that's what we go on.
292-8513, area code 614. 292-8513. If you'd like to join in our conversation here with Charles Kernighan, the head of the National Labor Committee, the committee which monitors sweatshops around the world and exposes sweatshop practices and unfair labor practices around the world. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle this morning on Open Line. This seems like an impossible task to monitor and to combat. I mean, these sweatshops exist around the world now. They exist in this country, no doubt. What can be done? You mentioned the law that that Congress is considering. The bill that Congress is considering is exposure at this point the best weapon against sweatshop practices?
Yes, because what happens is, you know, the companies go offshore. You know, we had a $711.6 billion trade deficit last year. We imported $2.33 trillion worth of goods and services. We're running deficits with China, $256.3 billion last year, Japan, $84 billion, Mexico, $73 billion. Like, in other words, we've had tremendous job flight from the United States, lost 3.5 million manufacturing jobs since January 2001. The companies are offshore. but they hide the factories. They won't even tell the American people the names and addresses of the factories they use around the world to make the goods they want us to purchase. So they've got sweatshops hidden all across China, Bangladesh, other countries. So, and then they say, look, we've got a voluntary code of conduct. We love workers, and we're going to monitor this situation ourselves. And, of course, you know, it's really, in my opinion, 90% of it's a cover-up, maybe 10% of it's accurate. So the only way to really put pressure on the companies is to expose them. And they do respond once they're exposed. I mean, and there are certain changes. I mean, conditions now are better than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You see, there's still child labor in the export industries, but not as much as you used to see. In Bangladesh, for example, there were 100,000 kids, little kids working in the factories. You'll still see children in the factories, but no, you know, it's not 100,000 kids. So there's been some improvements through the pressure. But the law, that's the big breakthrough. That would, for the first time ever, hold corporations accountable to provide the same legal protections to the workers who make their goods as they demand for their own corporate products and trademarks. And Congress can do it because a bunch of years ago, when the Burlington Coat Company was caught bringing winter jackets in from China, beautiful coats with like fur collars, for some odd reason they put the truthful content on the label. So when it said fur, it said dog fur and cat fur. So they were killing dogs and cats in China for their fur collars. And, of course, the Congress got really upset, and they passed the law. You know, immediately, they passed the Dog and Cat Fur Act of 2000 to prohibit the import of dog and cat fur into the United States, the export of dog and cat fur from the United States, or the sale of dog and cat fur in the United States. So the Congress has a backbone, and they protected the dogs and cats in China. All we're saying now is that's great, but let's try to protect these 16-year-old kids in Bangladesh. Let's try to protect these workers in China. Let's try to protect workers in the United States who deserve to have their legal rights respected.
292-8513, Charles Kernighan of the National Labor Committee is our guest here on Open Line on WOSU. Let's go to the phones. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hey, Paul. Go
hey,
ahead, sir.
About the good work. Hey, I was talking to a gentleman yesterday. It's kind of ironic. And he was talking about he's an ex-employee, I believe, of GM. I'm not too sure, but I do believe that's what he was saying. And he was telling me that when NAFTA came into effect and they shipped the transmission assemblies down to Mexico, that 60% of the product is scrapped and thrown away, and they're still turning a profit after they pay all the employees. Is there any truth to that? And after I've been listening to you guys today, kind of leads me towards believing that that's probably true. And I just that's you know, 60% of the material that they're taking and scrapping, and they can still make a profit. And they're trying to make all these free trade agreements just to basically what it sounds like and looks like just to put more money in their pocket. I just wanted to ask if that was true, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Thank you, Paul. Let's get an answer. Charles, do you look at the materials or just at labor at this point?
Mostly just labor, yeah. But, you know, if we see, you know, extreme environmental violations, we'll also jump on that. But it's clear with these free trade agreements, they're there for one reason, is to give U.S. companies access to low-wage labor, period. I mean, in other words, right now Nissan has about 2,400 engineers in Vietnam designing their cars. You know, they get paid 96 cents an hour. This, again, race to the bottom, it's just out of control. You have free trade agreements with no worker rights agreements, no worker rights protections. And in Mexico, for sure. I mean, there's wages along the border of Mexico. In auto parts, we saw Alcoa auto parts plants where they were making electrical wire harnessing systems for automobiles, which came right back into the U.S. The workers were getting like $1.22 an hour, up to about $2.45 an hour. You can't live on that. The workers were living in broken-down hovels without windows and all. I mean, it was, in other words, they're there for the $1 or $2 an hour wages.
Let's go back to the phones. Harry has a question. Go ahead, Harry. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning to our guest. And my question would be, have you had the opportunity to check out Honda of America, which operates in Marysville and several other states in the United States? They employ people through a DECO, which is a temp agency. They pay their workers half the price of their permanent workers, and you work just as hard, if not even harder, they promise you an opportunity to get employment after 2 years, but what usually happens is they end up just not calling people back and then starting a whole new group of people over at that low wage again. And after you build up your money, you know, they just let you go and call in another group of people. So I think somebody needs to explore or investigate Honda and Adecco. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Harry. Have you looked at other manufacturers here, like Honda?
No, we haven't. But I learned a lot in what the gentleman just said. And this is what our fear was in looking at Toyota, for example. And, of course, it would be the same for Suzuki and Honda and Nissan. They are pursuing the model that worked in Japan. Japan had a tremendous real estate crisis in the 1990s. And a whole generation of people were lost in Japan because the company stopped hiring people. They just piled more work up on the workers that they were currently employed. So they were doing 2-3 times the amount of work. And they moved big time all across Japan to part-time workers and subcontract workers and temporary workers and so on. They have perfected this model, and they're bringing it to the United States. So exactly the kinds of things the gentleman is describing, that's exactly what's going on all across Japan. The middle class is being destroyed. Japan was the most middle-class country in the world and is being dismantled at this moment. So I think I suspected this, but this gentleman taught me a lot. And this is a concern, the way they're pitting temporary workers against full-time workers, paying them less, telling them they're going to get a job in 2 years. This is exactly what we feared.
292-8513, 292-8513. If you have a question for our guest, Charles Kernighan, the executive director of the National Labor Committee. Getting back to what consumers can do and the exposure, how much of an impact does the exposure have on buying practices? We'll be honest. We love our low-price, relatively low-price clothing, our electronics at low prices, our HD TVs. We don't want to pay $5,000 for them. We don't want to pay $40,000 for a funny-looking small car. How do you overcome consumers' desires with trying to help folks in other countries who are working for, below poverty wages?
Well, it's really a matter of public policy. Any changes in the United States, progressive changes, enlightened changes, always comes about through either social movements or legislation. So, that's the areas that you look at. But a big part of that is popular education of the American people. If you look at the United States now, I think, of course, the American people, for the first time since they started taking these polls, I believe, back in the 60s, more than half the people say they're worse off financially than they were a year ago. This is like unheard of. And you can feel the middle class just being squeezed and squeezed to the point where, we're facing, possible disappearance of the middle class. Along with these trade deficits of the $711.6 billion last year, because of those trade deficits and the government budget deficit, we're borrowing $2.2 billion a day. That's $800 billion a year. We're selling off assets to the United States. And Japan and China, for example, hold over $1 trillion U.S. securities. So, in other words, what happens internationally in international trade, what happens in the global economy, is going to determine a lot about the living conditions and wage standards and working conditions in the United States. And right now, they're all going down. We lost another 62,000 jobs in June. We've lost 430,000 jobs in the first 6 months of the year. Our productivity is up 3.3%, but our wages are down. So it's not as if the global economy goes on in isolation and the United States just sits there. We're being dragged down by the global economy. So I think people need to realize that we need to take control of our country again. People need to be at the table to discuss what kind of a country we want to be. 6 out of 10 corporations don't pay taxes. American people won't even believe that. But 6 out of 10 corporations don't pay taxes. So that's, I think that's wrong. But the corporations, they have a right to be at the table to discuss our economy, but so do the American people have a right to be at the table. So I think that these sweatshop exposés and, it's not like we're just do-gooders trying to help poor people in the developing world. Of course, that's one of the big issues. But we're also fighting for fair wages in the United States and decent working conditions, because there is this race to the bottom. Once someone starts to spiral down and pays lower wages and forces workers to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, once that happens, then it just starts dragging everything down. You have to have a level playing field.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. David, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, David. Gentlemen. I'm really enjoying this conversation and hearing you get this information out. I really have a number of questions, but in the interest of time, I'll try to be succinct. Number one, I own a large staffing firm here in Columbus, and I want to respond to the information that was given about Adecco. You have to understand, given the volatility of a mass-producing company like Honda, you're going to have workflow. You're going to need people for, say, 90 days or 120 days in order to meet demand on a product or service or recall. They have no choice but to use temporary workers. And when they do, they still pay them $12 an hour. It's a superior wage, well above minimum wage, and they treat them extraordinarily well. And I can also attest to the fact that Adecco and or Honda never, ever tells an associate, guess what? You're going to have to be hired on full time. They are not allowed to do that, and they don't do that. The other thing, gentlemen, I heard him say that 60% of corporations don't pay taxes, and that's a very, very powerful allegation. I would love it if he could kind of quantify that, because I don't know anybody that's been able to circumvent the tax code, and that's always one of those threats that's thrown out there, especially around election time. The rich don't pay taxes, or corporations don't pay taxes, but it's far simple. And I'd like to hear a detailed explanation, if I may, please.
Great. David, let's get to your first point first. Temporary workers do serve a role in companies. You agree, Charles?
Yes. As long as they're not pitted against full-time workers, you know, it can be a slippery slope to the bottom. But done correctly, you know, it could be necessary.
What kind of guidelines do you recommend? I mean, David mentioned that the companies can't promise full-time work. Is that a fair concession to make? You also have to pay them. You're not going to pay them what the permanent worker makes. You're going to pay what a part-time or temporary worker would make.
You know, I don't know enough about the industry to really respond. What I've always gone by, when you meet like workers in a factory who are, say, organized and have a union, whether it's auto work or clothing or something else, they at least have a voice on the shop floor, a democratic voice. They can raise grievances. They can go through popular education. In other words, I think where a lot of the abuses become is if you take out that check and balance of workers being able to organize and have a democratic voice on the shop floor. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think the United States is really going downhill very quickly, is the checks and balances have been lost. People may like unions, may not like unions. It really almost is irrelevant, because if you don't have some checks and balances within the system, you can't expect, like, an individual worker in Tennessee to be able to go up against Nissan or something like that. It's just not going to happen. So I think that, in my mind, I think that's the real one of the – that's the real problem. Regarding the
– Yeah, the 60% – your claim that 60% of American corporations don't pay taxes. How do you come to that figure, and what is your evidence of that?
Well, it's a U.S. government study. The General Accounting Office came out with a study it's actually 61% of the companies pay zero taxes.
Are you talking corporate?
America. Huge corporations.
What kind of taxes? Property taxes?
Their income tax and their corporate profits.
Okay.
Because they hide the profits offshore in subsidiaries. And until they bring them back into the United States, they don't have to pay taxes. So they're just holding this money offshore.
How could you possibly state a figure like that? That is so unfounded to say 61% don't pay taxes.
It's right in the general accounting. Just go to the study. It's very available on the internet.
I'm going to. 82%. I'll tell you something else. Let's digress a minute here. Everybody in America wants the same thing. Everybody wants the best for the cheapest, the Walmartization of America. And for you to effectively say, you know, unionize this, unionize that, unions serve their relevancy. And now federal law mandates everything unions ever fought for. And now all they fight for is ridiculous wages that we're forced to go overseas in order to be competitive in this country. There's no way you can possibly support unions in this work environment.
Well, two things. I think that if you go to the General Accounting Office study, which is, again, the U.S. government, it'll show that 60% or 61% of corporations pay no income tax on their huge corporate profits, not a cent, because they hide the money offshore. Moreover, 82% of corporations in the United States pay corporate income tax. That comes to less than 5% of their profits, which is, of course, rates we don't get. So, in other words, there's an awful lot Because of lobbyists, because of the big money the corporations have, of course they write themselves all sorts of deals. I could go on in this forever because they just got a windfall profit tax to bring the money back from offshore at not 35% tax rate, at 5.5% tax rate. So some of the biggest multinationals in the world were reaping billions and billions of dollars of windfall profits because of this loophole that let them bring it back for 5.5%. So
that's why tax attorneys make so much money.
Exactly.
It's a very complicated system and how it works and trying to follow the money. But to get back to David's main point is that what the point I made earlier was that we like cheap stuff, and our workers are paid for the most part good wages, whether that's because of unions or because of good demand for good employees. Have we made our own bed, you know, that fosters this this need or desire on the part of corporations to look to sweatshops?
Well, I think it depends how we look at it. I think, like I mentioned earlier, in the recent Gallup poll, that more Americans feel they're worse off now than they were a year ago financially. People think the country is going in the wrong direction. This is not a high-wage country. It's skewed terribly. There's 28 million people in the United States. One quarter of all workers earning $9.08 an hour or less. You're talking about $18,800 a year. So we're not all millionaires. About half the workers in the United States are earning $30,000 or under. We're not all millionaires. Mm-hmm. In fact, 90% of all people earn less than $100,000 a year, except the 300,000 richest people who earn more than $1 million. That's one quarter of 1% of the U.S. population. They earn almost as much as the bottom 150 million people in the United States. So we are now having diversity, a disparity in income that goes right back to the Great Depression in 1928, before the Great Depression. In other words, our middle class is falling apart. Wages are going down. Like I said earlier, our productivity in the first quarter, American workers are some of the most productive workers in the world. Productivity was up 3.3%, but our wages continue to go down, and they're falling behind inflation. You had these 50 hedge fund managers.
Hey, Charles, let me interrupt you here for a second. We do have Steve Curtis from Toyota on the line. Steve, we only have about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you to make your point quickly, please.
Well, you know, thank you for the opportunity to appear here. I just want to be clear to all of your listeners here that we have zero tolerance for any of the practices that we're being accused of with the NLAC. We do not condone forced labor. We do not pit temps against our permanent workers. And we have very clear guidelines for our suppliers that we help them implement. We've got green purchasing guidelines that we initiated in 1999. We've been regularly distributing them to our suppliers. Those guidelines clearly describe what our expectations for suppliers are, and we expect them to comply with all local, national, and international laws.
Steve, you expect them to comply,
yes.
But can you say that they are in fact complying? Do you have any suppliers that are operating conditions that the committee describes?
What we can do is we can meet with them regularly to ensure that they're complying. For example, I'll give you an example. In February, we had a global supplier meeting with all of our Tier 1 suppliers to reinforce our purchasing policies as a company, including those pertaining to employees and working conditions. So we aggressively push these policies back to our suppliers. And in North America, I'll give you another example, we're engaged with the Automotive Industry Action Group, and their mission is to improve the guidelines and productivity within the industry, among other goals. So we're collaborating with them to develop stronger materials. We're also to develop better workplace practices. So the bottom line here is we don't condone any of these practices, and we work very, very hard to conduct regular audits of these operations to ensure that they're in compliance.
Thank you, Steve. Charles Cronin, you get the last word, 30 seconds.
Well, they're still attached to human trafficking in their subcontract factories that they're using across Japan. They're still involved with the vicious dictators in Burma. They do have a two-tier system where 10%, one-third, 33% of all the workers' attempts paid about half of what full-time workers do. I see plenty of problems. They have a long way to go.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much. Charles Kernighan, Executive Director of the National Labor Committee on WOSU on WH20 Columbus.